It's time to talk about Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. And now, here's Ira.
One of the world's finest jazz drummers is coming to Las Vegas. Well, not only a drummer, my guest also has built a reputation as a premier jazz singer and songwriter. You put it all together and you have drummer, vocalist, songwriter, and educator, Dave Toll. He's performing at VIX Las Vegas along with John Belzegai and Dave Loeb this Friday and Saturday, February 7th and 8th, beginning at 7 p.m. And for reservations, go to vixlasvegas.com. And for everything about Dave, go to David Toll, T-U-L-L, davidtoll.com. Follow him on Facebook and Instagram. Dave, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Yes, thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. Have you just tallied up the number of times you've been in Las Vegas over the years?
Oh, I haven't tallied it, but I think the first time I performed in Las Vegas was in the late 80s when I was with Maynard Ferguson. So it goes back that far anyway. What is that getting to be, about 30?
It sounds about right. You look pretty young for a guy that's been doing this for as long as
you. I appreciate you saying that. Thank you very much. I was 12 when I was on the band.
Yes, you were. And as I understood it, you started playing any kind of instrument at 8 months. Is that correct?
Well, it was. I don't know. Did you count banging on things as
yes.
playing? And we did have a piano in the house when I was growing up.
Yeah. Well, your mom was telling me that you were banging from the inside before you were born. So there,
yeah, I'm sure it probably was. Whether it had any rhythmic intent, I'm not sure. But, yeah, working on that kick pedal technique. But yeah, exactly. I took my first drum lesson when I was 10. So it's getting to be 52 years.
Great. How did you start? It sounds like it's such a cliche question to ask my guests, but it really sometimes is important for our listeners and viewers to get a sense of your background or any guest background before we talk about everything going on in the current state of affairs, including your upcoming appearance at VIX. So how did you get involved with music at such a young age?
My family was musical, although nobody else in the family was gunning to be a professional musician, but my parents both played. So we had music in the house, and I used to hear my parents play the piano. So I grew up with good music, and my parents listened to good music. So all of that was there. And I was banging on things when I was 8 or 9 years old. You'll laugh, but I had figured out the pitches of the cushions in the Dodge van that we had. So the seat was the low one and the back was the high one. So when you played along with the radio, you know, that's what I was doing. So funny, because when I was 9, my mom came to me and said, you know, Dad and I were thinking maybe we should get you some lessons with a drum teacher. And I wasn't into it. I was like, no, they'll wreck what I have. I remember saying that, which is so hilarious. But in any case, yeah, I mean, so I Berkeley, California is where I grew up. And the jazz program in the schools there was fantastic then, and it still is now. It's one of the true jewels, you know, for music education in the state of California. And we took it for granted because we didn't know about the fact that other school districts didn't have jazz bands starting in fourth grade.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
And the one guy who was running it, his name was Phil Hardiman, he was sort of an umbrella teacher throughout the whole district. So anyway, I came up through that program. And then when I was in high school, we were, a lot of players came out of the Berkeley High School band that have gone on to be professionals from my era and other eras. Mm-hmm. Notably, I was at the high school at the same exact time as pianist Benny Green. So he and I were in the combos and the bands together all through high school. In any case, I finished there, moved down to Los Angeles to go to Cal State Northridge in 1981 and got my percussion degree. 2 years after getting out of school, I had the opportunity to go out with Maynard Ferguson. That was 1987, and did that for a little less than 2 years. Did a couple of albums with him, started writing a little bit, which was a good thing. And I've just been hacking and clawing in Los Angeles ever since then.
Yeah, you're demeaning yourself. There's a lot of important people that you've recorded and performed with. So
sure, no,
dismiss that.
The scene in Los Angeles for my generation of players trying to break in, in the late 80s, get going in the early 90s, as opposed to players who arrived in like 1960 or 1970. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very different scene in Los Angeles as far as the recording industry and the ability to just know there was going to be tons of work. So my generation has always had to be very diverse and very varied in what we were willing to do, as opposed to just saying, well, I'm a studio musician or I'm a touring musician, you know.
Yeah, I was. You're funny. That's exactly what I was going to ask you. Was in the '60s and maybe even in the '50s, there were a lot of session musicians or studio musicians that was their entire career. They were working on albums and they made a nice living and and there's some great stuff produced, obviously, as well. But as you say, nowadays you have to be a little bit more versatile. Just out of curiosity, when you take the trash to the curb, do you play sticks on the trash can?
No, but I'm probably singing.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
and I might be thinking, I wonder if I could write a song about taking the trash, Or if I'm working on a song and I'm taking the trash out, I'm probably thinking, let's see, what rhymes with sliver? I'm like going through everything. So
well, let's talk about that for a second, because there are things that are not mundane in life these days, but ordinary in life these days. And you wrote a song and an album about it. The song is the texting song. The album is Texting and Driving. And I recommend people listen to it and they can get your album and listen to the texting song. How did you come up with that? And what was the inspiration? You clearly have a sense of humor, which is great. I love guests with sense of humor.
Well, yeah, it's funny because, I'm known for having songs that have humor in them, which I'm, of course, is my personality. So that's fine. I don't only write songs that are funny. I have a lot of songs that are different and all sorts of different subjects. An idea for a song just comes to me and I go, oh, that'd be good as a song. And if it happens to be funny, then there we go. But I do. I've always loved the comedians and songwriters, too. There aren't as many songwriters writing funny stuff as you'd think there would be. But in any case, especially in jazz. But I've always loved the ones who are kind of looking around the world and noticing the things that we've all seen but haven't really talked about, and that's where humor lives. At the time that I wrote that song, Texting and Driving, or the texting song, I was just fed up sitting at stoplights or having cars go past me and watching you look over and the person staring down at their hands, and you're thinking, this is not a good development in society at all. Thankfully, with talk to text, we've got a little bit not as much as it used to be, although people are still very distracted, and we've all waited behind that person at the light who didn't notice that it turned green.
Yes.
So anyway, it seemed like a natural fit. It crossed my mind one day, and I thought, I think there's enough information there to put a song together. And then, of course, the next 6 months, I'm hacking it together and figuring out what it wants to be, and it's an interesting process. But anyway, that's where that song came
from.
Yeah,
it was number 5 on the Billboard Jazz charts. It was number 3 on the Billboard Comedy chart. And then I think 23 weeks on the Jazz Week.
We did have a little run there.
On the Jazz Week chart, too. So the way I see you is you're sort of a jazz Tom Lehrer, for those who know.
Well, and I appreciate that. And I love Tom Lehrer. I remember listening to Tom Lehrer. And there were a lot of funny songs. When I was coming up, there was a show called Dr. Demento. I don't know if that's still around.
But yes, I think he's still syndicated. Starting in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Hey, when I was a kid, I used to listen to Dr. Demento. I mean, he was always playing all these silly things. And of course, there are a few people writing great stuff. Now, we've lost Dave Frischberg, but I think of him as being probably the premier. I mean, really, a premier songwriter, again, kind of like the way I think of. He wrote a lot of great songs that weren't funny, but he had a knack for writing humorous stuff. And another one that comes to mind is Jay Lenhart, who is in New York City, the bass player. He's written several really, really beautifully crafted funny songs. So there are a few of us around.
That's good. No, that's good. I in the intro, I mentioned Educator, and you talked about Berkeley. So I would imagine that you're desire to teach comes from your experience at Berkeley. Would that be right or wrong?
Well, it wouldn't be quite so direct as that. It's interesting because I think maybe once I had the opportunity to start doing teaching, I teach part-time at Pasadena City College, and I also teach a program that's just about to start, as a matter of fact, for the Los Angeles Jazz Society. It's called the Bill Green Mentorship Program. We work with students who audition and provide them with lessons. But the teaching sort of came along on its own. However, when I started doing a lot more teaching, certainly I was reflecting back on the great experiences that I had and what things worked and what things didn't in all the places that I went. And a lot of curious clinics that I went to as a young player, going to these jazz clinics where you're like, what am I supposed to do with this curious piece of information that this person wants to convey? So it's definitely informed my teaching a lot. But I wouldn't say that it came straight out of there. You know, the first 20 years of my career, I really wasn't looking to teach much. If somebody called me, I was glad to do it. But the opportunity came along in 2008 at Pasadena City College, and they're flexible with me so that I can take some classes or teach students. And if I have to be out of town or travel or do something, or I've got a session, I can move things around. And so it makes it possible to do it. And I love it over there.
Yeah, except just the drive is always, I'm sure, difficult in Los Angeles.
Unfortunately, Pasadena City College is about 3.5 miles of surface streets from my house.
So not bad, actually, for Los Angeles. That's very good. So
here I am whining about driving and everything, but actually I have a pretty good commute on the days that I go over there.
Okay, so now you're coming up to Las Vegas, and you're going to be at VIX Las Vegas February 7th and 8th, beginning at 7 p.m., and you've got John Belzegai and you got Dave Loeb. And how do you put it all together when you do a jazz set? Because different jazz musicians I've talked to on the show talk about a lot of improvisation, and they may not know exactly the set that they're going to be working on. Have you thought through what you may or may not be doing?
Well, I have usually a list of tunes out of, it's funny, I'm getting to the point where I've got about 35 songs that I've written that are in my book, and I don't get to all of them on any given gig, but I like to cycle them through. Plus, I like to squeeze in an occasional standard as well, because the audience likes that. And I love all the American Songbook tunes too.
Right.
So when I'm traveling, especially, I'll send a list ahead saying, here's the 27 songs I'm going to be picking from. And I'll send lead sheets and maybe some recordings for reference. But my particular gig, the players have to be just the best at the highest level of readers, especially when I'm traveling. So Dave Loeb and John Belzegai are both a couple of the best sight readers that I've ever worked with. It's really a special to have them on the gig because of that. So we can run over a beginning or an ending at the sound check just to make sure that we know kind of what the song is about, but it's really not necessary unless something's really unusual to actually run a song all the way through before we perform it. So it means that I can be fairly flexible. There are some singers who are more cabaret style, who they've got the exact set listed out and they have their patter that they're going to say in between every tune. And I'm not like that. I'm much more of a jazz sensibility. I'll change the set around as I go, but it's mostly my songs, mostly my original tunes, a lot of humor, a lot of stuff that's not, you know, intended to be humorous. I just try to have a good time.
Which is great. I think usually when the performer has a good time, the audience has a good time.
I think so. Even when I screw up, I have a good time.
You laugh at your mistake and the audience empathizes and says, yeah, of course.
No, that I've set sense. Myself up with a lot of lyrics that I try to remember. And I'm bound to forget some of them somewhere on the line. Okay. But I've worked, you know, as a drummer, you work with so many singers. And I've sat back there and watched a singer who had music on a stand, and they're just spending the whole night staring at this music stand, you know. And I just thought, man, I'd rather forget this section of lyrics than spend the whole night staring at this music stand.
So, yeah, it's a little too much linear work when it comes
You know, well, that's I appreciate it. If somebody's standing right up in front and it's a really big show, you know, totally, I get it. But I'll go ahead and fly as one of the songs that I wrote, Fly by the Seat of My Pants, and we'll just see how it goes.
Exactly. While you're texting.
Yes, exactly.
Of course. It always seems to me somebody that can sing and drum at the same time, there's a select few. We can think of a few, including Ringo Starr, but It just seems that it's an unusual talent because your hands are doing one thing, your voice is doing something else, your brain has to somehow separate those two functions, but also integrate those two functions. So have you ever thought about how you're able to do that? I know it's easy for you, but I stand in awe of people that can do that. I have no clue how you do that.
Yeah, well, it's funny because my perspective is so funny. I mean, you know, if you've sung for 25 years, and of course I didn't start singing professionally, you know, on gigs until I had been a drummer making a living for 15 years or so.
What led you into that, though? Wait a minute. Yeah. What led you into that?
I mean, I was always singing. It was just that I never really thought my singing was something that I'd perform. I never, you know, I was working with all these singers, and, you know, I just figured it must be a lot harder when you get up there to do that, and I'm not going to sit back here at the drums and pretend, you know, hey, I could do it better. But I started sitting in a little bit because I had songs that I had in my head, and hey, on the third set on somebody's gig, hey, you know, could I maybe sing a tune? Well, you? Oh, well, sure, you know. And I started figuring out that I was okay at it. Meanwhile, I started writing some tunes just because things occurred to me. So it all kind of came around organically. Getting back to what you were asking about, you know, I've been playing drums since I was 10. I had the time feel is a thing that I'm happy and I don't understand, but I was born with it. So it's just a very lucky roll of the dice genetically, I suppose. And yes, when you sing and you play the drums, you have to do a little bit of dividing up because you want to be able to phrase freely as you sing, while the drumming has to be more regimented, has to be the thing you're phrasing against. The thing that most people don't realize, because they always imagine that it's these two things competing with each other, and what's they're always surprised to hear is that they're all coming from the same place. I mean, if I'm phrasing a little bit back, I'm never just random. It's always connected to the basic time feel. It's just that it's back a little bit. And so it's never about pressing these two competing things together. It's just like having a fifth limb, you know? My right hand's doing one thing. My left foot is doing another. My voice is doing another. But they're all connected. So it really isn't quite so much of a division as you might imagine.
So your fellow musicians, when they're playing along, they're following the beat you've established with the drums. They're not paying attention necessarily to what you're doing vocally.
Well, hopefully they're not. Yeah.
I mean, they're not falling asleep on you, but what I mean, right. They're concentrating.
When it comes to keeping time, when it comes to my role as a rhythm section member,
right.
The time has to be solid, you know, and you can't lay back on a phrase as a vocalist and then let the drums lay back. So yes, you're right. And I think that a certain amount of, when I work with students and we talk at the drums about time feel, one of the things that I'm always trying to impress upon them is that basic inner anchor. I visualize it like a tree trunk. And when you're little, it's a little sapling and a little breeze can bend it. And as you keep pushing on it, it gets stronger. And 10 years later, that same breeze won't push it over, but a wind will still make it bend. And maybe another 10 years goes by and now a strong wind won't move it at all. It's the same way that time builds inside a good musician. And so, especially a drummer. And so you just get to the point where you can pull and push and do whatever you want, but that basic quarter note stream is not going to, it's not going to change for anything.
So when your fellow musicians that are performing, whether as a trio, quartet, whatever you have, or in your current case at Vix, when they're following you as the rhythm section and you're singing, and let's say you sing something you just come out with something, you improvise, and it's something funny. Are they hearing that and able to react to it and still keep playing, or are they kind of tuning you out because they want to focus on the rhythm?
Well, you're talking about a couple of different things all at once.
Of course, yes.
I definitely am a jazz-focused show, so I want lots of solos. Again, some singers like to just have a little 8-bar piano solo and then back to the melody, but I followed the lead of the great Jack Sheldon, who I worked for more than 20 years. And for him, the singer just was the person playing the head of the song, and everybody soloed, and that's what we were doing, and that's what I do. So, players like doing my gig because they're getting to solo. And I'm soloing a little bit at the drums. If I'm soloing, it tends to be vocal improvisation, or what a lot of people call scat singing. So if I'm doing that, they're tuned into that like they would be to a horn solo, or you know, anything that's going on. If I'm doing something humorous, like if there's a humorous lyric in the song, or some other thing that there's a funny line, sometimes the sidemen, the side musicians will hear it and get it, and you'll see somebody chuckle or whatever, especially right. if they're new to the song. Right. Sometimes they're so focused on reading the chart, because we probably haven't ever rehearsed it. Sometimes I can see that those things will slip by, because they just have to be focused on getting that C minor 7 chord in the right place. So it's a little mixture of things. But hopefully nothing I'm doing is so disruptive that it's going to cause the whole thing to go off the rails.
you mentioned, you know, you're ahead of me, because I had a question about Jack Sheldon. I was going to bring it up, and you mentioned him. So this is a good time to ask the question.
Yeah.
You were with Jack Sheldon's quartet, and I think from 1991 until he passed away, right? That was roughly that.
Right? Yeah, I need to look up what the first gig was. I can picture it. Whether it's 91 or 92, it's somewhere right around in there, yeah.
Some people know of Jack Sheldon's background, others do not. But for those who do not, he was associated with The Tonight Show. Am I correct?
It was Merv Griffin.
Merv Griffin. Okay, yeah. I was right. I should have said that first, but... Mm-hmm. Quickly corrected myself before you corrected me. So this was good. I got two correct.
Oh, good. And he used to get that a lot, by people come up and say, "Oh man, I watched you on the Tonight Show for all those years," and he would just go, "Yeah, great." You know, he wouldn't even correct him.
Yeah, I did it myself just now. So, but I corrected myself, and then you corrected me. So it's great. So with his background there, and then going on the road with him, he always struck me as having also a great sense of humor about himself.
Oh. He was one of the funniest people I've ever dealt with. I mean, even whether it's as a band leader or just as a person, he was one of the most funny people I've ever known, and one of the quickest improvised humorists that I've ever met. And very obscene.
Oh, interesting. All right, then. I didn't know that.
He was great at finding that thing where you were like, everybody would go,
"Oh, yeah,
that's awful." But man, is that funny. You know, you couldn't. he was brilliant.
When you look at the people you've recorded with, and I'm not asking you to pick the top three, as I sometimes do with the guests, it's more who had the most impact on you when you were recording or performing with them that either influenced you musically, or just the fact that you realized there was another level that you could aspire to by being or performing with them?
Yeah, I mean, that. I think you just draw a little bit out of every experience you have, whether you're recording or you're touring or you're working with somebody a lot. And so I'm heavily influenced by so many. I mean, we were talking about Jack Sheldon, the way he sang and phrased, the way he ran the band. Those are all things that were big influences. When I started leading my own group, I think my first gig that I actually led was in 2007. That gives you a little bit of an idea how long I worked as a drummer without being a leader. But definitely I was patterning the pacing of my thing and the way I did things after the way Jack handled those things where, you know, the singer would sing the song, but then everybody would solo. It wasn't just a quick little solo. Lots of blowing, as we jazz musicians say. And, of course, I was doing my original tunes, which was different from what he did. And also his phrasing. I mean, I there are specific spots where I'm singing a song and I just catch myself and go, "Oh, that was a Jack Sheldon inflection right there. I can't get away from it." You know, there's just ways he soloed and the way he sang that were so influential. But then, you know, looking at other people. Working with Barbara Streisand, which is relatively recent, 2016 to 2019. And if she does anything else, technically, I guess I would probably be doing it. I don't think she's going to perform anymore. But working with her, her level of professionalism and the way she balanced being a performer with being basically a producer. It's tough as a leader. You know, you have to be not just thinking about the music like you do as a side musician, but you have to be thinking globally about everything. And Barbara was amazing, man. She never sang a bad note the whole time in rehearsal or performance that I was with her. But then she would be in the middle of a song and then she would turn to a camera person or something and say, no, 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 you're coming across too fast. You need to go slower than that and lower the angle there, that right there. That's okay. Let's get back to it. And then she would just jump right into the song. So figuring out how to manage all that peripheral stuff while still keeping your mind on the music, you know, I watched her and thought, wow, you know, you really have to bring a high level of energy to the table to make all that happen and still be able to give what you need to the music.
Yeah, that's if you think about it, I know some people complain that certain performers want to do every part, but if you can do it, meaning produce and direct and perform, then you got to let them do it because they know what they know what works. They've been successful for decades. So why not go with the flow, which is great.
Well nobody's going to go to Barbara and say, I don't think so.
No. Hi, I'm Dave Toll, and I suggest that you do that.
I suggest
it. Yeah. Why am I on the outside of the building all of a sudden?
Yeah, right. I know.
So what?
And then, you know, I always joke, I've worked with so many singers. You know, as a rhythm section player, you have the advantage and the disadvantage of working for just so many vocalists because it's just the way it is. I've worked, you know, I always think about the perspective that a rhythm section player has where I have personal experience with maybe 100 singers. I don't know, I've never counted it up, but over the years, so many. Some things that are great, some things that weren't. Some vocalists, you can't believe how wonderful they were. Some people you wouldn't want to hear again, but you're influenced by all of them. And so, you know, working with Cheryl Benteen, for instance, from the Manhattan Transfer, she's impeccable. And her phrasing is amazing. And she's so much fun. And she changes it up from night to night. Her improvisatory skills with the phrasing are amazing. And yet she never is off pitch or off time or anything. So I'm influenced by that. Then, without naming names, you know, you'll be playing some gig someplace with somebody. Maybe they're even a famous person and you're sitting back there playing and you hear them do something really awful. And you just think, got to remember not to do that, you know, or that timbre, the way they hit that high pitch and it got edgy. You notice little things that you want to not do. Sure. So all of that goes into some big cauldron that ends up being what I come up with on the gig.
Do you ever take notes about the things that you should or should not do after each working with a big performer that you can learn from? Do you ever take notes or just you just put it in your brain and you remember?
It just kind of goes into my brain.
Yeah, I get you. Now, you're never when you're performing with a major talent, and you're a major talent too, but what I mean by major talent is a larger than life entertainer.
Sure.
You're not texting while you're drumming, are you?
No. Although I'll say that there were times during the specifically during the Barbra Streisand rehearsals, because there would be a lot of rehearsal for those shows. It was very complex and lots going on and video and all kinds of other production things. There would be times where it was easier for Randy Waldman, the music director, to send a text to the band. Literally, we're all standing there, but rather than calling across and being another voice in the room while they're talking about the things, he can just text and say, I think we're going to go at letter C, you know? And so that was the only time I ever know of that texting was going on while we were playing.
That's a very productive use of texting. I like it. That's great. Hey, before I let you go, is there one favorite song that you're going to be bringing to VIX that you always perform no matter what? It doesn't have to be a classic or from the Great American Songbook, but just your personal favorite song that you're going to be performing.
Well, you know, most of my songs are originals, and so choosing a favorite is sort of like asking who your favorite kid is, you know.
Yeah, I guess I'm doing that.
But one of my favorites, it still rings personal after all these years, is a song called Please Tell Me Your Name. It's on the Texting and Driving album. I always love doing it because everybody can relate to it, but it just tells the story of that situation where somebody comes up and they know all about you and they remember your name and you've done so much stuff with this person and all of that. And you can remember everything except their name. And you stand there in terror talking to this person for 10 or 15 minutes, hoping you're going to remember it, trying to not let them know. And so I'll always include that one. And I know if I've got an audience that maybe is not sure if they're into what I'm doing, if I pull that one out, we're going to grab everybody.
Yeah, you're touching humanity there. Well, that's a great way to leave it. My guest has been drummer, vocalist, songwriter, and educator, Dave Toll. He's performing at Vix Las Vegas along with John Belzegai and Dave Loeb this Friday and Saturday, February 7th and 8th, beginning at 7 p.m. And for reservations, go to vixlasvegas.com. For everything about Dave, go to davidtoll.com, and you can follow him on Facebook and Instagram. Dave, thanks for being on the show.
It's my pleasure, and thank you so much for inviting me. Hope people will come out. We'll have a lot of fun.
Great. See you next time.
You've been listening to Talk About Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. Hey,